Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When it comes to privacy, the Netherlands punches above its weight. The country of just under 18 million people has been able to spur major changes at several of Silicon Valley's biggest companies, thanks to its carrot and stick approach and the EU's landmark data protection law. New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer spent weeks studying Dutch privacy audits of Google, Microsoft, and Zoom. You can find a link to her recent article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Natasha Singer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again, Anne.
So I'm always asking about how U.S. Policy compares to the EU. How did you get interested in this story?
Well, you know, I've been covering privacy for a long time. And one of the differences between the United States and Europe is that we do not have a federal privacy law that gives us rights over our data. You know, we have narrow laws. As you know, we have HIPAA that protects our medical data. There's a Video Privacy Act that protects our data about what videos we rent. But Europe has this law, the General Data Protection Regulation, and it basically says that, you know, companies must minimize the amount of data they collect about people, and they must reduce the purposes to which they use it. This law came in Europe a few years ago, and what's happening is the Dutch are beginning to enforce this law, not by cracking down and levying fines, but there is a mechanism in this law to conduct these deep data protection audits to see what data is being collected and where it's going. And these reports are just astonishing. They're like 200 pages long or more, plus technical reports. And the Dutch government has commissioned these reports, you know, on huge platforms like Microsoft Office, Microsoft Windows, you know, Google's suite of apps for businesses and for education. And so they have, as a government, been able to see what's happening in some of these platforms that, you know, a school in the United States or even a government agency in the United States might not know about. And they found things that they thought were problematic. And then they delivered these audits to Google, to Microsoft, to Zoom, and said, like, here are all the things we think are major data protection risks, and you guys have to fix these. And it was interesting when I spoke to the Dutch negotiators because, you know, they said, you know, we're just the Netherlands. And so when we go to a huge American tech company and say, look, this is problematic, in the beginning, the companies are often like, you're the Netherlands, you don't count. Like, why should we fix it for you? But in fact, these are European-wide laws. And although the Dutch are trying to enforce these laws just for the Netherlands, these laws apply, you know, everywhere. And that's hundreds of millions of people in the European Union that Microsoft or Google wouldn't be able to supply their tools to. So it's a very interesting lever that the Dutch are using to get big tech companies to actually change their data practices. And the benefit for us in the United States is Google doesn't want to change their policies just for the Netherlands or just for Europe. So some of these changes are worldwide. And so people in the United States and elsewhere are benefiting from what the Dutch are doing.
Explain again why what the Dutch do affects the rest of Europe. I mean, obviously it's part of the EU, but it's commissioning these reports on its own volition, but it'll trigger EU action?
So let me give you an example.
Okay.
The Dutch commissioned an audit of the set of tools known as Google Workspace for Education. And those are tools like Gmail and Google Docs, but that are specific to schools. Because, you know, in the Netherlands, schools have to be in control of the students' data. So Dutch schools wanted to know, where's our students' data going? What is Google doing with it? And they came back and said, you know, there are a number of significant privacy and data risks, Google, including that you're collecting all kinds of data that the schools don't know about and are not in control of. And we need you to build a tool so we can see what data you're collecting. Now, they're referring specifically to diagnostic data, which is like the tens of thousands of little details that companies collect about how you use an app. So if you're using spell check and you like write a word one way and then erase it and spell it a different way, you know, they're collecting those kind of details. And, you know, initially, Google did not want to make these changes. And then the Dutch have a federal agency, the Data Protection Authority, and that agency weighed in and said to Dutch schools, you know, you're not going to be able to use these Google tools anymore unless Google makes these changes. And so Google agreed to make these changes. They have sent their proposed changes to the Netherlands. They were due in December, and now the Netherlands is testing them, and there will be new privacy controls and new kind of data transparency tools. But I spoke to Google and they said, well, they're testing it in the Netherlands, but we're going to roll these out worldwide, right? So first, because this data protection law in the Netherlands is a European-wide law, what it means is if the Dutch said that Google was violating this law, right? The French or the Danish or the Germans might say, okay, the Dutch said you're violating it, so you're likely violating it here. So, you know, it made sense for a company like Microsoft or Google to say, well, we'll make these changes European-wide. But then you're going to have American schools saying, wait a minute, you fixed this for European schools and not for us? So it's both convenience on the part of big tech companies to make worldwide changes and a kind of benefit for consumers worldwide. You know, we're benefiting from this small country applying this big leverage to big tech.
I'm kind of interested in how the Dutch is taking, how the Netherlands is taking the lead on this, and where their resources are coming from for this, and because it is a very small country.
So, you know, I think partly they are a very digitally savvy and tech forward nation.
Yeah.
So they have been thinking about this, you know, for a while. And I think that they got the idea that these audits, which all companies have to do if they have some kind of risky data processing, and in Europe, risky data processing can mean processing sensitive data like medical data or doing large scale processing of lots of people with lots of data. So companies and schools and everybody has to perform these audits under the law anyway, but the Dutch just decided to do this in a super deep way and, you know, produce these. First of all, the process takes years, right? They are hiring companies in the Netherlands, consultants, to perform these deep, both technological audits and legal analyses. And that takes, you know, small teams, a huge amount of effort, but it's not involving hundreds of people on the Dutch side.
Okay.
And when you mentioned the carrot and stick approach, I think that's what's working. So, you know, the stick is we've done this audit and we found these problems. But the carrot is if you fix these, like you will, you know, then probably be compliant in the rest of Europe and you'll look good in front of your customers worldwide. And the way they've been able to do this is they have gotten high level executives involved at every company. So, for example, they found lots of problems with Zoom in the beginning of the pandemic, you know, and Zoom had their, you know, executives in, you know, cloud computing and security and privacy and legal talking to the Dutch, you know, maybe every week in these long phone calls. And, you know, what the Netherlands figured out was you can't just have the privacy person from a company on the phone because they don't know what the technical changes are and they're not authorized to make the technical changes. You've got to have the engineering teams that can make the changes and tell you what's possible. And you have to have the executives who can greenlight these changes. And, you know, Zoom ended up, you know, publishing blog posts saying, look, you know, we collaborated with the Netherlands, we made all these amazing changes. And I had a similar conversation with Microsoft. You know, Zoom was a much younger company. They had many more things to change. But Microsoft said, you know, they really appreciated it because when the Dutch do these things, you know, that the government commissions these audits, they're also offering contracts that are national. So it's not just one school district. The Dutch are negotiating, you know, with Google Education on behalf of all the public schools in the Netherlands and all the universities. So if you make these changes, you're selling to a much larger audience as opposed to negotiating with New York City schools.
These are changes.
So the technical ability to see these issues, the legal wrangling to say you got to fix these. But also, you know, there's a benefit, which is that Google doesn't have to have this conversation with every different school district in the Netherlands.
It's sort of like, I mean, I would imagine the tech companies say this is stuff worth doing. It sounds like the Netherlands is doing a lot of their work for them.
Well, you know, the Netherlands, you know, for example, the Ministry of Justice commissioned a report on things like Microsoft Office because lots of people in the government use Microsoft Office. It's their platform. And one of the things they found both with Google and with Microsoft was, and this was not in the story because it was just a detail we didn't have space for, but there were certain spell check features that are, you know, online and connected. And if you were a member, you know, worked for the Dutch government and you're using the spell check feature, it would send not only the sentence you were writing, but the previous sentence and the next sentence to Microsoft or Google, because the AI looks for context in spell check. But if you're the government, that meant sometimes your entire documents were going to Microsoft or Google in the
because
United
there were
States.
A lot of spell checks.
Right. Yeah. And that's not very secure. And like, I'm not sure that, you know, people in other places understood that their entire documents might be going to these companies, and that if you were a government agency, that might not be secure. So the Dutch said to Google and Microsoft, now these things, these extra, you know, AI spell check connected features are going to have to be off by default in the government versions, or like, we're going to have to be able to turn them off. And, you know, it's the ability to see and ask questions about things that many companies, school districts, government agencies don't have the technical expertise to find, let alone press for changes about.
It sounds like the Dutch have done a really good job of working with these companies too, treating them not as adversaries, but as partners.
I mean, I think in the beginning, the companies really did not want to deal.
Yeah.
But, you know, Microsoft and Zoom both said they really appreciated the process and they felt that they had benefited. And Google said, you know, they talked to regulators all over the world and they didn't think that this was particularly different, but they did say Google said they appreciated the technical expertise at which the Dutch were operating and that Google had responded to that.
In 2019, and maybe this is what you just described, but Microsoft introduced a new privacy and transparency policy that applied to its cloud customers worldwide. Was that what you were talking about?
That's one of the things. Okay. And also the Dutch insisted that Microsoft make a tool so that customers could see all these like diagnostic data, like the spell check changes or whatever, that Microsoft was collecting, because the Dutch report found that Microsoft Office, like PowerPoint and Word, was collecting up to 25,000 different types of user activity. And so in response to that, Microsoft created this tool that allowed customers to see this data that they never were able to see before.
So consumers in the U.S. eventually benefit from all this regulation in the EU, right?
I think we are. I mean, I think schools in the United States, you know, Google is an extremely complicated platform for schools because, you know, there are these core apps like Gmail. There is YouTube, which is not part of the system, but schools use. There are Chromebooks, which are, you know, laptops with Google operating systems. And I think it's really hard for most school districts to understand the data privacy implications. So the fact that Google plans to roll out these changes that were designed for the Dutch worldwide will benefit American schools and school kids in terms of privacy.
What, I guess this is the, you know, the $56 million question or whatever. What could regulators in the U.S. learn from the Dutch, learn from the EU on all this? It's not impossible to regulate big tech?
Well, I think it's not, like, look, partly, Europe has a law that they can use as a lever and a cudgel and a carrot. Mm-hmm. And so companies have to comply, because if they are found in violation, they could be fined hundreds of millions of dollars. We do not have that lever in the United States, although California has a similar law now. But I think that unless you do these deep technical analyses, then you don't know what's happening. And it's hard to say this is problematic if you can't see it. So, for example, in the United States, the Attorney General of New Mexico sued Google over the education stuff and said, you know, that it was some of the stuff Google was doing in schools was deceptive because it was using students' data for business purposes, and that shouldn't be allowed to happen. And the case was settled. And one of the settlement points was that Google agreed that schools in New Mexico can now get early access to new Google education products. But the Attorney General of New Mexico was not able to stop Google from using students' data for business purposes. The Dutch were, right? Because under the European law, you have to minimize the purposes for which you use data. And if you collect it for schools, you can't use it to like make new products.
Has anyone turned the Dutch down on this score?
You know, if they have, they haven't told me about it.
Okay.
I know they're looking at other platforms. But, you know, as I said, Google refused initially, and the Dutch Data Protection Authority had to step in and threaten Dutch schools, right? And it was after the threat that Dutch schools would have to stop using these products that Google agreed to make the changes. So, you know, I think that if companies don't want to do it, the Dutch go to a higher government authority to try to nudge these changes into being.
And by the way, you write that some U.S. tech companies find that getting an okay from the Dutch is sort of a status symbol. It's a badge of honor.
Right, because if the Dutch say your thing is okay, you can go to the Norwegians and the Danes and say, you know, we made these changes for the Netherlands, and so this should be okay for your schools too. It doesn't mean that regulators in Germany might not find some other thing.
Yeah.
But we've seen both Zoom and Microsoft, you know, write these blog posts about how they're cooperating with the Dutch, and now the Dutch say they're compliant. And it's like, you know, the good housekeeping privacy seal of approval or whatever. It's like the Dutch said, this is all right. And it means that, you know, your big tech company has passed one of the most stringent data protection audits and compliance processes in Europe.
I wanted to ask, just one more quick question before I have to let you go, Natasha. Is this an ongoing process? Is this a longitudinal type of audit thing? Okay.
Right. It takes years, both the audits and then the negotiation. But once the companies agree to make the changes, then other independent experts are hired to make sure the changes were made.
Okay.
And then, of course, the companies update their software, and then it goes through again. So, I don't see that there's an ending to this process. Once a company agrees to work with the Netherlands on this, they're going to have to keep working with them.
Natasha Singer, thanks as always. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Natasha Singer is a technology reporter for the New York Times. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Tech platforms, especially Twitter, failed to heed their own employees' warnings about violent rhetoric on the platforms and went out of their way to avoid aggravating conservatives, including and particularly then-President Trump. That's according to a memo circulated within the January 6th committee that details how most platforms ignored the red flags, waiting until after the attack on the Capitol to address extremist content. Washington Post technology reporter Drew Harwell was part of a team of reporters that dug into the findings. He joins us now. Welcome back, Drew.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So this was a memo. We call it a memo, but it was about 120 pages, right?
Yeah, this was kind of a full report at the end of this, you know, long process in which the House Jan 6 committee interviewed a ton of people, had subpoenas and depositions, and focused all of their congressional firepower on this one question of what happened on January 6th. So this memo was kind of a write-up of what they had found from all of these interviews and where they felt like the committee should go next.
What's the upshot of the memo about the role of social media in the run-up to the January 6th attack?
Well, you know, it suggested what we all know, right? Which is that social media is a hugely important factor in not just, you know, American politics, but in just daily life. And, you know, the memo suggested that these companies were not taking this problem seriously, even in the weeks going up to January 6th, where you could see people really agitating for violence in the real world, saying, let's go to the Washington on January 6th, some people talking about bringing guns, agitating for President Trump, who at the time was effectively saying our democracy was corrupted. And these companies were really just not treating it like the issue that we have now seen it is. And so the memo was sort of drawing this line and saying, you know, there should be some structure for how these companies are held accountable for not treating this problem seriously. And, you know, the frustration was that the import of the memo wasn't really, you know, pulled together into anything that would actually create policy for the future.
Right, into that final 845-page report.
Yeah.
But they did use references to the social media role in all of this during the January 6th hearings. I remember they would kind of show, you know, snapshots of different tweets and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, they did. And they were very sort of light mentions, I guess, is how, you know, there were multiple teams from within this committee that were looking at this problem from different angles. The purple team was the one that was looking at kind of the internet portion of it. So involving social media, what Trump was able to do, how people were organizing online. They did a ton of interviews with people from within the companies and without about the role of these companies. But by the end of this process, the purple team's results and the social media importance were effectively non-factors. You saw a few references in you know, the hours of committee hearings, but you know, the worry from people who were on that team and just sort of watching was that everything was about Trump himself, and the focus was on one man, when really there was a systemic issue, and there was this whole industry that, you know, touches all of our lives, you know, even more than Trump in some ways, that was kind of left on the cutting room floor. So the feeling among the purple team and the people we've talked to and the people who know this memo was, why not include this in a more incisive, deep way? Why just sort of leave this out? And the frustration was they were feeling like some of this was politicized. They felt like, you know, people like Liz Cheney and Lofgren were responding to other sensibilities, right? The focus was, how can we not be too critical of the tech companies in the case of Lofgren, or how can we make this into something that focuses on the farthest of the far right, right? Make this into a QAnon thing, as opposed to really examining the role that maybe mainstream Republicans and maybe, you know, the Republicans who were online sort of agitating for Trump's, you know, for Trump's lies about the election. So there was a feeling that this didn't go far enough.
I guess, well, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with a Washington Post technology reporter, Drew Harwell. He covers artificial intelligence for the Post, and we're talking about a 120-page memo produced through the January 6th committee, but not included in any kind of significant way in its final 845-page report. And it has to do with the role of social media and how social media platforms managed or responded to violent rhetoric that was floating around in them in the run-up to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. So this politicization of it, I mean, when they're talking about how could you, I guess the whole idea of the January 6th committee was, how could this happen? And they want to pin it on kind of one guy. But I'm thinking, well, that's like pinning a murder on one guy, but not mentioning the weapon he used in the murder. Right. I mean, this was a weaponization of a platform, some people suggest. Right.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And that's why they feel like some of this was a little myopic, because it tended to just focus on this one specific instance without any, you know, broader examination of like how we got here in the first place. And, you know, and like you said, I mean, this was an unprecedented investigation. It is rare that we get Congress really focusing their attention on one issue as impactful as this one. And, you know, there was a lot of people power that went into this, a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of resources. And, you know, the feeling was, we have this material, we have this look at social media. I mean, this is a huge moment in American history, and using this online tool that is still very new to all of us and whose, you know, impact we're still trying to understand. Why not treat it with the seriousness it deserves and include this, you know, and forget about memos and full reports. I mean, the feeling was, you have this information, you have this material. Why are we not sharing it with the public and passing, you know, strong policy recommendations and standing up, you know, a response force for if or when this happens again? So yeah, that's a good point. Just focusing on the one man or the one day felt like a total missed opportunity.
So the data's there. They've got the information. You know, I just finished an interview with Natasha Singer from the New York Times about how the Dutch are bringing the big tech companies to to leash, I guess, with their audits and whatnot. And it always, I mean, I know I've talked with you about it and asked you, well, what are they doing in Europe? What are they doing in the EU? Is there some kind of aversion? Is Congress averse to tech issues and taking it on?
Yeah, it has been interesting to see Europe because, you know, the rap against Europe in the U.S. is, well, it's not their companies, right? This is a Silicon Valley thing. These are American companies. They're jealous or they're, you know, overly doctrinaire and they treat these things too critically. But, you know, the flip side of it is that we just don't do anything about anything in the U.S., right? I mean, we don't have a comprehensive federal data privacy law, right? You don't really have any data privacy rights. We don't have a law like that. And, you know, for so many years, the criticism was, you know, the federal government just doesn't understand this technology. They don't even know where to start with these regulations. And it's actually changed in the last couple of years to where now there are certain members of Congress who are very aggressive about certain tech issues, right? You see all of these 25 states banning TikTok and them, you know, wanting to ban TikTok for everybody nationwide, or, you know, dinging Google for censoring conservative voices or all these things that, you know, but they focus on these really granularly political football issues, but they don't pass any broader framework for how tech should be used in our lives. And it goes back to that broader problem of like, we all know technology is important to our lives. It's every day that we're looking at our phones and our computers and our kids are looking at these things. And yet we just get focused on these tiny issues and leave out the bigger problem of extremism and disinformation and violence and all of these things that the government is best placed to deal with.
Several former Twitter employees said that a large part of Twitter's failure to act stemmed from a deference to Trump. And this was before Elon Musk, of course. The company treated his account differently, they said, in several important ways. How so?
Yeah, Trump's account wasn't even able to be viewed in the same way as every other account on Twitter. In the back end, you know, Twitter employees could sort of review every account to see, okay, what's our history of, you know, assessing reports of this account or what's their criminal rap sheet effectively. Mm-hmm. Trump did not have a rap sheet. So he was effectively on zero strikes forever. And that was just kind of a technical side of it. I mean, the bigger issue that came up from former Twitter people was they felt like this is a guy who is one of Twitter's biggest stars, right? He brings people to our platform every day. He has made Twitter, which, you know, is effectively an also-ran in social media, into the biggest quantity in American news and entertainment. And so there was a feeling of we can't go at this person who is so pivotal to our company's survival, which, you know, is really, I think, eye-opening for people because they saw what Trump was using his Twitter account to do, right? I mean, we all saw. And so, you know, there was also sort of a feeling from inside Twitter that, well, no matter what we do, he's not going to change his behavior. So there was also sort of a resignation about the limits with which the company could respond. But it all sort of ended up in the same place, which was inertia, allowing Trump to continue tweeting without consequence about these, you know, important issues. And we saw where it ended up on January 6th with, you know, even as people were knocking down windows, he was effectively saying that they had a point, and, you know, people were tweeting, hang Mike Pence. And so there was, you know, there was a failure to hold Trump's account to account, but also, you know, the company, the responses from inside the company that day were really shocking. I mean, the employees who were tasked with dealing with these violent threats on Twitter were totally flat-footed. I mean, they were talking about being in their apartment in New York and having one screen and having to use the same app as we all use and search for specific search terms and then sort of, you know, suspend each tweet one by one while thousands of tweets are being posted every second. And so this was a company that, you know, was not on a war footing at all, was not really ready to deal with the problem that was coming at them based off of what their company had helped create. And, you know, a lot of this had stemmed from this failure to sort of imagine how bad it could get. That was sort of the feeling from former Twitter people to the committee.
So any lessons going forward then? I mean, I don't even, who knows where Twitter is now on anything, but any evidence that social media companies, these platforms, could be better prepared? I guess it would have to be a constant state of preparedness in this day and age.
Yeah, and that's kind of the bad ending to all this is that Twitter is now a very different company, right? It's run by one guy, Elon Musk, who has his own policies, which are very different. Of course, he's reinstated Trump's account. Trump hasn't tweeted yet, but he's reinstated not just Trump, but he reinstated a white nationalist Holocaust denier today. You know, Twitter has become a very different and I think a more crass and crude place, as our reporting on the hate speech explosion there has become. So, you know, a lot of the lessons that could have been imparted by Congress were not only not shared, but they could have potentially gone on deaf ears in Twitter's case. I mean, you've seen some of the other companies treat this a little differently, but you still have, you know, we're still 2 years out from this incident, and it's been effectively, business as usual for these companies. They've still been responding with the suspensions here or there. But, you know, the discussion right now in Facebook is, do we give Trump his account back? So we're really kind of back at square one.
We've got different states doing different things. You mentioned Texas and Florida. You know, they want to restrict what content social media platforms can remove. California's passed legislation requiring companies to disclose their content moderation policies, which, you know, as California goes, often so goes the rest of the country eventually. But I'm wondering, with all these different state laws going into effect, how confusing it's going to be, and does it increase, does it improve the likelihood that there'll be a national imperative at some point?
I think it does. Right now, as it stands, they're creating this strange, you know, patchwork quilt where every state is going to have a different social media law, which, of course, doesn't make a lot of sense, right? You can drive over the border and your app doesn't change. The California, Florida, and Texas laws are all sort of, they have their own kind of political sheen to them. I mean, especially with Texas and Florida, where the state is saying that Twitter can't take down certain content, even if it's anti-vax, even if it's, you know, a bogus sort of conspiracy theory, this kind of stuff that Twitter was deleting for a long time, mm-hmm. that Elon Musk. So, you know, you're seeing these sort of state efforts crop up that have this political sheen to them. And you're seeing at the federal level, there being some agitation for something that would resemble a social media moderation law. But would this get us to something that would address January 6th? I actually don't think so. These are actually going at different parts of the problem and actually framing the companies as dangerous because they were moderating too much. And, you know, so you see they're actually being two sides kind of seeing a different reality, to where, you know, the people who are pushing some of these state laws are suggesting that actually the problem that was that Twitter was too censorious, was taking down too much, whereas the people who were actually inside Twitter were saying the problem was we were too permissive all along. I mean, we were allowing threats and violence on our platform just because people were saying them in a specific way or finding ways around the rules. So maybe this all snowballs into a federal law, but I don't see both sides really even agreeing yet on the problem.
Well, on that note, Drew Harwell, thanks a lot for your time.
But it is a beautiful day outside, so there are positive things out there. Sorry to leave you on a sour note.
No problem. That's Drew Harwell. He's a technology reporter covering artificial intelligence and more for The Washington Post. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Microsoft on Monday announced it has extended its multi-year, multi-billion dollar investment deal with OpenAI. That's the startup behind ChatGPT and DALL-E. The company says the funds will help it develop AI, artificial intelligence, that is increasingly safe, useful, and powerful. Here to tell us more is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, safe, useful, and powerful. I'm all
These are actually really important things for Microsoft to announce, because some of the people listening to the program today may be old enough to remember a couple of years ago when Microsoft decided to release their own chatbot, and they had to pull it very, very quickly because it learned from the internet and then suddenly accidentally became racist. So Microsoft has a huge interest in working with organizations that have managed to avoid that. And ChatGPT, which is the big product that OpenAI has been celebrating for some time now, has been out in the world for quite a bit. And while there are a number of things that have been pointed out regarding the accuracy of some of the information that ChatGPT provides when like prompted to do things, it tends to not, one, take a side politically on a lot of things, but two, it tends to have really good filters for things that are just like directly inflammatory comments.
What's the deal? I mean, it's multi-year. What's it worth?
Yeah, so I mean, the goal here for Microsoft is to have a kind of front-facing artificial intelligence that can work with its data in order to provide useful answers to questions and help users for things. This could be as simple as a chatbot that helped Microsoft customers solve problems with their computers. It could be as advanced as a databasing tool that helped programmers kind of build the framework for the next app that they're working on. There's actually quite a bit that can be done with this, because the thing that ChatGPT is spectacular at compared to a lot of the other artificial intelligence sources out there is sounding human or being visually human when you read the dialogue that it goes with. And that is something that is of extreme importance when trying to take this artificial intelligence construct and provide that data in kind of a mainstream way. I pick on my sister a lot when we talk about new technology in this show, and she never lets me forget it. But one of the big things that I think about is someone like her going and saying, hey, like, I locked myself out of my computer. I don't know my password. How do I reset my computer? And, you know, that is the kind of thing that Microsoft has really detailed step-by-step instructions for. And having a chatbot that can conversationally explain those steps to someone is a really big deal to Microsoft.
This all comes right after Microsoft announced it'd be laying off 10,000 or so workers. Coincidence?
It's definitely not a coincidence. It's also worth highlighting that within that same period, Microsoft hired the musical artist Sting to perform for executives at Davos. You know, there's a lot of kind of questioning that comes and after any layoff is, you know, how can you, you know, kind of make these kind of things. It's worth highlighting that very, very few of the positions that were cut from Microsoft were a part of their artificial intelligence projects, which Microsoft knows is something that they have to have quite a bit of engineering power behind in order to continue to be competitive right now. But it's, you know, the biggest places that you saw those layoffs were actually in Microsoft's gaming divisions and you know, kind of support for Xbox and studios that are building new titles. In particular, 343 Industries, the team that is behind the Halo franchise for Microsoft, are where you saw a lot of those layoffs.
And what does that tell you?
It says that Microsoft has made a lot of acquisitions over the last couple of years, and they've done an enormous amount of staffing up, and they responded to market conditions by letting a whole bunch of people go. However, their total headcount is actually still higher than it was in 2019 when they started doing all of these hiring and acquirings. And it's fairly common when you see a company do a bunch of acquisitions is to follow up with kind of what they would consider trimming the fat. This happens at a period of time where it feels like every major tech company is reducing headcount by about 5 to 7%, mm-hmm. which is a unique trend to be paying attention to, but it seems at least on a surface level unrelated to this AI investment.
But it seems like it is related to a proliferation of chatbots in my future.
That is absolutely a thing that is going to continue to happen. Yeah, we're you know, we've already reached a point with Google where if you have the right phone and you're able to make the right request, that you're the artificial intelligence on your phone will call and make appointments or reservations at restaurants on your behalf, as well as kind of services on the business side that are trying to make all of that a little easier. Those kind of things are you know, kind of day-to-day use things that Microsoft is nowhere near being able to offer with any of its services, even in a business sense. And so it is of note that that this is kind of the competitive push that they're making is because they're, Microsoft, among the three companies that are kind of doing this, Google, Apple, and Microsoft. Microsoft is fairly behind.
Why do you think that is?
That's a really tough question to answer. I'm positive that there is no such thing as one answer to why this is. I will say that this is not the only avenue where Microsoft has had this issue, when it comes to, sticking to a browser, even though Microsoft has put an enormous amount of money into its next generation web browser. The very first thing that a lot of Windows people do when they buy a new laptop is install Chrome. The Microsoft's own search engine has lost an enormous amount of money year over year, even though it delivers pretty decent results, especially for people like engineers and web developers and things like that. But Google is still kind of the default search engine for most folks of the age that would be, looking for alternative ways to search for things. This is, Microsoft is not seen as a leader in artificial intelligence or, kind of big data searches and things like that, unless you are a big company and relying on something like Microsoft's Azure service. But as far as like the day-to-day customer, that is something that Microsoft is going to work really hard over the next couple of years to try and reverse.
I was just thinking about going cashless and what the prospects are for that. And you wanted to talk about how big banks, including JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, the Bank of America, are working together to build their own digital wallet to compete with Apple.
That's right. So Apple Pay has really come out as the default, mobile payment system after a lot of different companies, including Google, tried to release their own versions at right around the same time to be competitive, including a bunch of individual banks. Bank of America had their own tap to pay service for a little while, and so did a couple of others. Those individual services are really hard to convince someone to buy or to sign up for. If you're a Bank of America customer already, if you already have Apple Pay on your phone, why do I need to install this other app in order to use this thing? The one thing from that entire kind of bubble that survived from all of these banks making these efforts is the account-to-account payment service called Zelle. And that was a service that was made by a company that works with all of the different banks. Their name is Early Warning Services. And they built the Zelle app, and it has continued to be kind of a dominant way to transfer money. It's built into just about every banking app now to be able to make those transfers. And a great deal often safer than PayPal, which was, kind of the default method of doing that beforehand. But with mobile payments quickly becoming popular and Apple starting to do things like offering specific rewards if you use Apple Pay in order to pay for things, which grabs, kind of additional data from the people making those purchases. The Wall Street Journal reported that there is a new effort to make something to compete with Apple Pay, and they're planning to release it in basically the same way that Zelle was released. So instead of having a new app that you would need to install, it was something that would be built into your banking app, basically, separate from kind of the Zelle experience. But a single point where you can go, oh, all of my banking stuff is already here. I can just push a button and pay in the same way that I would with Apple Pay.
And so the idea of them all working together to do this is to make it uniform, that kind of a thing.
That's right, because you'll be able to, you won't have to worry about the individual companies making, negotiation agreements with all of these different companies with a single group going to, say, Best Buy or something like that and saying, we want to set up a rewards program with you or we can have this kind of data exchange. That's a lot easier to do with one, one group instead of, kind of nine different companies trying to do the same thing.
Where are we? I mean, what's the temperature on digital wallets at this point? How many Americans, for instance, do we know?
We don't have exact numbers. I know that across the U.S. it has continued to become popular. It's something that grows with basically every new, phone that is bought, because one of the big parts of setting up is saying, hey, did you know you could pay with your phone? It's something, you know, entirely anecdotal, but I see used considerably more in the last 6 months than I have ever before in a lot of the places that I shop. Not as many people using, say, from their watch, but almost exclusively from their phone, where you can kind of tap and make that payment. And really, you're also seeing, I think kind of bizarrely, in my opinion, a lot of people using tap to pay from their credit cards. You know, a lot of credit cards now have that near field token built in, where you just tap the card and it starts making that payment. That same functionality is going to come to your phone. So whether that that creates that shift in behavior where someone is willing to kind of pull out their phone and make that tap instead of just using their card is something that's going to be really interesting to see as this app actually becomes reality.
You know, I talked about this years ago on probably Tech Tuesday. I can't remember if it was with you or not, but it was about the prospects of this in developing countries and in rural areas of the United States where banking is very difficult to come by, brick and mortar banking and that kind of a thing. And this is a huge thing. I mean, for most of us, or for a lot of us who have access to a bank and that kind of a thing, it's like it's a novelty and it's a convenience for sure. But for some people, it's a huge thing. It's a huge developmental tool.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to keep in mind that for a whole lot of the world that is not, what is considered, first world countries, their phone is their only computer. And so having, that single method of doing things is always super important. The way that we use our phones to handle financial transactions is wildly different from what is used in China, where almost everything comes through a single app as far as sending money and communicating. It's almost like a big version of Facebook, where all of the like banking transactions happen, including just walking into a market and kind of having a barcode on your phone that makes those payments. So the US is kind of unique in the way that this is rolled out. And in rural areas, the original kind of tap to pay infrastructure wasn't catching on as well because, buying a new credit card machine is expensive. But in the last couple of years, we saw, the federal government making it mandatory to update those processors because it was reducing the amount of credit card scammers that were, identifying older systems and kind of taking advantage of them. And that's a big reason why, especially like gas stations and things like that, very quickly moved to update their credit card terminals in a lot of places.
Are you a bird watcher?
Sort of.
Okay. You wanted to talk about the smart bird feeder, Bird Buddy. We only have a couple minutes, but I want to talk about it. Tell us.
I think this is super cool. This is essentially a bird feeder that has a camera built into it and Wi-Fi access and some kind of AI smarts so that when a bird lands on the feeder and starts to eat or starts to play or does anything, when the camera recognizes that it's a bird, it starts to record and it sends you a notification. So even if you're not at home, you can take a look and see what's going on. And it's just a really cute thing. I was reminded as I saw this, this actually review that my colleague Andrew Block wrote on this Bird Buddy. There's a TikTok and Instagram user, this guy who does an enormous amount of work to get hummingbirds to come and sit on him and do things. And it's like one of my favorite things to do. And this feels like a really relatively inexpensive way to accomplish something similar.
And it identifies and everything.
Yeah. So there's a lot of camera software that'll tell you what kind of bird was seen. And it'll also keep track of how many birds it sees in a particular area. And offer some suggestions if you have things like if there's not enough sunlight in a particular area or something like that, over time it will say, hey, with better placement, you might have better access to this kind of bird, which is really kind of cool.
They're not cheap. They're a couple hundred bucks, but they're back ordered. They're expected to ship in April. They've been a hit, right?
These have been incredibly popular, and yeah, they started about $200. There's a solar attachment that you can get to it for another $70. That'll make it so you don't have to swap the batteries out or recharge it every once in a while, as well as a water feeder if you want to do more than just feed them birdseed. It's a really impressive kit, I have to say.
I'm gonna check it out, Russell Holly. Thanks so much as always.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly works as the managing editor for commerce at CNET. That is it for now. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.